right. Joy. Joy week. Joy week number, whatever it is.
Permanent joy.
We're getting there. It's October. October is joy month.
It needs to be.
We need something.
No kidding. Everyone, that is Nisha Sharma, one of our very favorite people, who we are going to talk to today about all sorts of things that make her feel joy, including very likely the 50 Shades movies, because apparently that's a thing we talk about now.
Every episode. Here's the other thing, though. Nisha, how long have we been talking about having you on for this episode?
Probably like a year and a half.
For sure, right?
Yeah.
Because immediately you were like, I have a topic, and we were like, yay, and then, you know, here we are.
You know, we're all just doing our best.
It's okay. It builds anticipation. You know, it's like the legend is now here.
There you go.
But we have talked a lot about Nisha. I feel like everyone feels like they know you. You know, well, let's do it. Welcome to Fated Mates, everyone. I'm Sarah McLean. I write romance novels and I read romance novels.
I'm Jennifer Prokop. I am a romance reader and critic.
And we are here with Nisha Sharma, who also writes and reads romance novels and also YA novels.
That is the truth.
And we're very excited to have you, Nisha. Thanks for joining us.
Yay. I'm excited to be here, even though you guys totally called me out for my 50 Shades obsession.
Oh, and then did you see is the episode out? Well, by now the episode is out where we also tossed Andy Christopher just right under the bus.
You know what? No, there is no shame. Anything that brings you joy in 2020, we are here for. And I have watched all three movies and will tell you, I have had a great amount of joy from watching those movies.
Me too. I really enjoyed that far more than I should have.
Well, I also, here's the other thing. I'm always doing show notes, right? I'm always looking, like, and I found all these hilarious articles about things that, like, we talked about. Like, there was an entire article I saw in Business Insider, I swear to God, about, basically, it was like the 50 Shades Darker movies are lying about lipstick.
I love it. Do you feel like you missed out on, like, a cultural juggernaut? Because, wait a second, now I have literally blocked out the 50 Shades episode, Jen. I've only read the first book.
So what's really wild is the second two movies are my canon now for what happened.
They're pretty close to canon.
Yeah, I have no idea.
I mean, they were written by E.L. James's husband, sure. So I mean, I can't imagine that they wouldn't be close to canon.
Agreed.
But they are. I don't think the second one ends in the same place as the books, but maybe we should turn to our expert.
We do. We have an expert here.
The second one does not end in the same place as the books, no. But what I will say is that, you know, the movies are... I've always enjoyed the movies more than the books, even though I did devour the movies at a rate that is alarming.
You mean the books?
The books, I mean. I absorbed the books at a rate that is quite alarming. Like, the third one came out when I was still in law school. I started with the first one, and I would only read it during tax law. And I swear to God, I almost failed that class because I was reading E.L. James the whole semester.
Well, it's fine. At least it wasn't contract law, because then it would have gotten confusing.
Right.
Maybe.
You were like, that's not what I learned in 50 Shades. Yeah.
I feel like I've somehow slipped, like, the contract, like, a relationship contract in every single one of my stories, like, even if it's, like, a passing comment, because it's, like, an homage to, like, my time with E.L. James.
I love it.
So she has made a lasting impact, and no one can take that away from me.
Never. Nope. And no one should. No one wants. Certainly no one here wants to.
I'm like, I loved it.
But wait a second, because I gotta say that I'm unsurprised now. So I knew what interstitial Nisha wanted to do for 18 months, and I am unsurprised now that I know that she was like a midnight attendee at these movies, and she had all the gear.
Nisha, I think you need to tell us about your topic. We are along for the ride.
We are here to talk about organized crime and mafia romance. I am so excited.
Oh, goodness. Woo.
Woo. exciting. You guys, there is a whole big pool of mafia romances. It's interesting because in doing the prep for this episode, and as everyone knows, like, I don't actually prep for episodes usually at all. But I was like, I want to have a sort of casual ability to drop lots of names. And I was like, I have, I don't know, 6 or 7 names that I can sort of drop off the top of my head, including Cressley Cole, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I went down the rabbit hole on Goodreads lists today, and I was like, who are all these people? Yeah. What is this world that I have opened? This can of worms that Nisha Sharma has opened for me.
It is glorious.
So now I'm very excited. I'm excited to talk about it. I'm excited to hear Nisha's recommendations. And I'm excited to get really to the bottom of organized crime romance. Because as I told Nisha, I grew up around the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so sexy as you would think. To me. But I'm going to get to Russians. I did not grow up around Russian mafia.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that mafia stories are really interesting because, like, they kind of fall into that same problematic category that we all have, you know, we've kind of identified the subgenre books that have fallen into that category. But it has that, like, rose gold tint to it that romance gives it. And that is what is, like, makes the whole story, all the stories, very attractive.
Yes, because I will say, having grown up, so I sort of today was like, how much am I going to talk? Like, how much of real me am I going to reveal here on this episode?
But let's do it.
So whatever. We're all friends. So I grew up in Rhode Island, and my actual last name is extremely Italian, and my father is Italian, Italy Italian, mm-hmm. not what we would refer to in Rhode Island as Italian, which is more of like a mafia Italian, is Italian. But my dad got to America and he got a job in Rhode Island working for a scrap metal company, which was run largely by the mafia, unsurprisingly. I mean, we've all seen The Sopranos. And so when I was growing up, my dad had a lot of friends who were kind of connected in the family, not my family, other
the family,
family,
right?
The family. And what's interesting about it is, like, when you grow up in that world and you sort of go to events with these people, and I think we spent a lot of time, like, there were a lot of, like, business things that we had to go to. Because my dad worked in scrap metal, where, like, there would be a Christmas party and all the children would be invited. And you'd go, and, like, if you were like me, who had read a bunch of books about organized crime, like, knew a lot about the mafia because she'd watched a ton of the Godfather movies, and, like, hadn't actually lived that world, like, the perception of that world is a very odd, like, walking into that world is a very odd experience. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much money, mm-hmm. and there's so much sort of, like, this sort of sense of, like, hierarchy that doesn't make a ton of sense. And there's always, in my family, like, with my dad, there was always a little bit of, I think, nervousness. Like, he was always keenly aware of, like, the line that he was not willing to cross, and therefore he was always an outsider because of that. And it's interesting because as he got older and then retired, and then he was more willing to talk about the kinds of people who we were interacting with all the time. But what I will say is they are generally not that smart as people. And that's sort of makes a lot of sense, right? Because mm-hmm. the hierarchy of kind of bruiser mobsters is designed for there to be, like, a capo, right? Like, the head of the mm-hmm. family. And then, like, everybody else sort of falls in line. So, but I will say this. Being the child of somebody who worked in a scrap metal company, and also somebody who read a lot of, you know, romantic suspense, and was a very sort of interested in storytelling, I absolutely don't understand why more people don't put people into car crushers and disappear bodies, because that is a real easy way, it seems, to get rid of a body. Huh. And very likely why the mafia, probably a lot of people do get disappeared in car crushers. But if you've, we'll put a link in show notes to like what a car crusher does, but it basically takes a regular sized sedan and turns it into a cube.
Huh.
I mean, there was an episode of Bones once where they, where she was able to find the killer, like who was like, who had murdered someone in a car crusher. So I feel like there's always a way if someone is really interested, but you're right. I feel like the mafia would use car crushers as like,
I mean,
most...
it feels like. So, yeah. And I can remember like saying to my dad one day, like going, cause I worked my first summer job. I worked at the scrap metal company on the, like I worked for like weighing scrap metal as it was coming. I ran the scale.
Oh, wow.
And so like, you know, people would just drive their, like, giant trucks would come in, like, with their beds full of scrap metal, and you would weigh them going in and then weigh them coming out, and that, and then they get paid. And it was sort of, you know, the characters who came in and out of there were the characters you would imagine kind of came in and out of there. And I can remember asking my dad, like, once, like, have you ever found a dead body in the car crusher? And him being like, what is wrong with you?
You know what this makes me think is, like, every place you are must have its own, like, place where dead bodies get disposed. And I have zero,
sure.
I have zero connection to the mob in any way, but I do vividly remember in fifth grade, Mike Winslow's dad was an FBI agent in school. And
hey, Mike Winslow.
Hi, Mike Winslow. He came day, like, the FBI agents came for a day to basically, like, scare all the little elementary school kids. And I remember, I swear to God, I have vivid memories of them talking about, I grew up in Cleveland, how they would, like, basically put cement shoes on people and drop them into Lake Erie. And I remember being like,
do you think that's real?
I swear to God, I remember just, like, being in the school gym all day and them scaring the shit out of us by talking about dead bodies in Lake Erie and how drugs were going to kill you. And it really worked for me.
I mean, it did.
It worked. Worked.
It does feel like this mythology of the mafia or the organized crime mythology is very real in a lot of cities, right? Because now I live in New York City, and there's that whole, like, cement shoes in the Hudson. And then there's, like, Hoffa. Isn't he is he Chicago?
New Jersey, or New Jersey, I think. New Jersey. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And then there's like Capone in Chicago. Oh. Like, it feels like there's sort of this constant sense of like organized crime being in the zeitgeist.
In Chicago, you can, before times, one of the like most popular tour things is you could go on the like Chicago, the Al Capone tour.
There was nothing in Al Capone's vault. But it wasn't Geraldo's fault.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And they would, like, take you all around to all the places where Al Capone killed people.
Shout out to Tom Hardy, who just played Al Capone.
Okay,
in a movie.
Listen,
it was
a really bad movie. That was a very upsetting movie.
Don't watch it, everyone.
Do not recommend. Like, I was like, hot Al Capone. And I was like,
but well done, Tom, for taking a risk.
Nice try. 5 points for effort.
Wait, so Nisha, we both have these like gangster stories, but like, you picked this, so...
Tell us why,
friend.
Well, first of all, like, my reference points are, like, TV shows like Bones, so let's start there. Like, I'm not exactly the most knowledgeable about, like, the real, true mafia situation that's in our world. But I grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is...
Home of The Office.
Joe Biden's hometown.
It is Joe Biden's hometown.
Shout out Joe Biden. Everybody, please make sure that you vote early if you're going to vote early. And, you know, you get in line on election day and stay there.
Yes. All of that. Everyone. Scranton, Pennsylvania. So it's actually, it's like a hotbed for organized crime, or it used to be.
Really?
It was. And we used to... I went to like a preparatory school, and in this preparatory school where like I was a scholarship kid, there were a lot of very expensive vehicles in the car, in the garage and in the car lot. And we'd all, you know, kind of wonder like, is that family money? What kind of family money is that? Like, is it still happening?
Family money.
Exactly. Right. And I've always liked crime shows. My like genesis of, you know, romance the genesis of my romance obsession was this 1970s Bollywood movie that deals with organized crime, because corruption is still a huge problem in India, and it's kind of part of almost like an accepted part of conversation in a lot of, you know, of the South Asian homes that I have, you know, been a part of or I've gone to, where it's like, oh yes, like the police cop, you know, the cops and the police chief, like they will accept money and, you know, you have to pay off this person in order to make this Bollywood movie. And so the concept of like dirty money and organized crime is something that, you know, I've lived with, and it's not necessarily been something that I've ever been fascinated to explore like in real life, but when it has that rose gold tint on it and you start talking about these families that will do everything for each other and you start looking at, you know, how a hero will go through, literally commit murder in order to protect a woman. Like, I feel like that because of the genesis of my, like, you know, romance career, it has become a point where I this is now part of my like history, and I love organized crime for that. I will say that I'm very hesitant to always write it versus read it because I am a woman of color and the books that I write feature, you know, South Asian characters that are right now, almost all of them are Punjabi. And, you know, there's a drug problem in Punjab. There's a huge drug crisis in Punjab because of organized crime and a lot of corruption. So it is something that, like, I have tiptoed into in the Singh Family trilogy, but I'm hesitant to write a diverse mafia story because I'm afraid that sometimes when a woman of color or a person of color will write a story with that identity for the main character, it opens doors for false narratives that could be potentially damaging to the community as a whole. So I'm very careful about the words that I put on the page right now and the types of characters that I put on the page. But I do love the idea of diversifying all of the messy, complicated stories that take chances. And right now, I think organized crime is primarily very white and straight. And, you know, and I do enjoy the stories, but, like, I feel like we need to put that disclaimer out there, right?
Well, that whiteness is real. It feels like, you know, Jen and I, we've never done a interstitial on them, but we have talked off air, if that's how we refer to this, about motorcycle romances being a real problem, too, because they're often sort of wrapped up in organized crime network as well.
Or right.
At least they sort of do the same family work. And I want to talk about found family being like such a cornerstone of romance. And maybe that's part of why we find these books so appealing. But first, I want to just piggyback on what you were saying about it being very white, because I think motorcycle romances are also extremely white.
Yeah.
Like, there are several subgenres in romance that are traditionally extremely white. And largely it's because these subgenres, we're valorizing a very specific kind of criminal.
Yeah.
Namely white and cis and het.
So to me, the big three, like, really white, really heterosexual, cisgendered, it's mafia, cowboys, and motorcycle clubs. Like, those are that's like the trifecta of that.
That does feel like the three. I can't think of any others that are super. I mean, I think there are certain like areas of sports that do that. Like, I think the hockey romance.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe that's the fourth.
But I don't know. I don't mean to.
Okay. But what I was going to say about that, though, is the thing that I think is really interesting about those three, maybe we'll put aside sports, maybe that's like a separate way in which we just like whitewash things, is cowboy, like in popular culture, though, they're not the only one of those that's like big, like has a through line of being big for a long time, I feel like, is Mafia. Like cowboy movies.
Even cowboys?
Well, I feel like they kind of have their heyday, like it pops up. But like we are pumping out cowboy romances every goddamn month. Like maybe there's like one big cowboy movie every 10 years, one big Western. Right? See what I mean?
And the most recent one, it feels like it was Brokeback Mountain, which sort of throws out the whole...
Right, so it's like, whereas maybe back, if you're talking about, like, the 70s, where it's, like, Gunsmoke, and it was, like, TV, and all that was, like, ongoing. Mm-hmm. And then maybe with Motorcycle Club Romance, I guess there was that TV show people watched,
Sons of Anarchy. Nisha, were you a Sons of Anarchy fan?
I was not, actually.
Yeah, and I don't really watch TV, right?
Me neither, but...
It was like, too close to, like... It was too close to the truth for me.
To white supremacy.
White supremacy, and I couldn't do it. Like, that's not the kind of romance that I'm here for.
Agreed. Cowboys, like, at least the way it works now, cowboys and motorcycle club romances feel really like a romance-only genre. Mafia feels like a very American genre.
Yeah. It's like a cornerstone of American culture.
And the thing, and again, I know it's very cisgendered and cishet to talk about it this way, but I think my question is, and I don't have an answer, is are romances, many of which are written by women, answering or like responding to a way in which a lot of straight white men love mafia stuff? And I just don't know the answer to that.
Are we arguing that straight white men are that women don't come for like The Godfather or like the or Sopranos or any of the like mafia stuff outside of romance? So, because I feel like I did. Like, and I love a mafia.
Sure,
movie.
I do too, but here's my question. And maybe it's different. The Sopranos probably is like the last thing I really watched from beginning to end in that genre. I am fascinated by the way in which women exist in that world, but I was never under any illusion that women were a main part of that world.
No, and also in all of these, there is always the sense of, like, the knife's point. I think what happens in romance around mafia, around the sort of organized crime, like criminal mafia concept, is similar to what happens in all media, because there is always a sense of, like, you may not want these men to succeed, right? Like, there's a balance between, like, do you want them to win or not? And in romance, there's such a morality chain story that gets sort of wrapped into the mafia story that doesn't happen in other books, in other forms of media. Like, when you think about that morality chain storyline in organized crime movies or television shows, whenever a woman enters and like tries to pull someone out of the family, they die.
Oh, yeah.
Either the woman dies or they both die, right? Mm-hmm. Every time I go out, they pull me back in. I mean, it's like a famous thing from The Godfather.
Right. Absolutely. Right. And so I guess I would say that to me feels different. The way in which the story plays out. I mean, I don't know. I can't speak to that.
But in romance, she wins, right? Like, she pulls. Yeah. She
and I'm just going to go ahead and say, I have never in my life, in all of my years of reading romance, ever read a queer mafia romance.
I will say this. Today, I went looking for a queer mafia romance. Like, for just because I was like, surely I've read one. Right? Like, and I looked at the queer mafia list on Goodreads, which we will link to in show notes, because I'm unable to recommend any of those books because I haven't read them. But there is a large, it seems like there is a large subgenre of the subgenre.
Okay. Yeah.
I think that in self-publishing, people are doing amazing work. Yes. They're trying to really bring added context and texture to this subgenre, this in romance. And, you know, I was trying to think of the last, you know, few queer mafia romances that I read that I really enjoyed. And you're right. Like, they're so, like, they still are so few and far between. But that Goodreads list, I think, will help in if people are, like, specifically looking to explore that, you know, that subgenre. But I think that to kind of go back to Jen's point, there's something that's really amazing that's done in mafia romance with the female character. Mm-hmm. And it's like the authors are always trying to give them a sense of agency and a sense of power, even though that the power dynamics and the power structure that exist in the story aren't in favor of, and you know, I know we're talking in binary terms right now, but it aren't in favor of the female character. And that's what's so fascinating to me. Like, how does this woman get power? Yeah. And, you know, and like Cressley is a great example of that. Like Cressley gives power to the woman in so many different ways.
Yeah.
But Cressley also really, obviously, we spent a lot of time that first season talking about those three books, right? The Professional, The Master, and The Player. And I mean, two of those books are, Jen and my, I would say, like, they're in our top 10 romances of all time. Absolutely. So, but what's interesting about what Cressley does is Cressley removes the hero from the crime. Yeah. Almost instantly, right? None of those, all of those heroes, well, in The Player, it's not actually the case, but in the first two books, those heroes make their money in organized crime. But you never see, the closest you get is in The Professional, right? Where he works for the Don. But in The Master, he just has a ton of money.
Yeah, he's trying to get out, maybe.
Right? And I think that there's some, there's like, that's a very overt and solid choice as a writer for those characters because, I mean, it is a tricky thing. Like, showing characters doing bad stuff on the page. And, you know, you think about, I think about, like, so there's Cressley, and then, of course, Jen and I talk about Annika Martin a lot. On the podcast, and we love those Annika Martin books. They are fabulous. But again, those heroes are doing, or the hero in the first of those Annika Martin books is doing bad things for a moral reason, right? Like, it's I mean, well, Eric would be like, vengeance is not moral. But like, it's also not like, I'm going to steal your booze, right?
Or it's, I just want money, or it's, I'm a, you know, a psychopath. I mean, like, you know, what's funny, because we're going to talk a lot about, I think, like, women in these worlds. And I feel like you're right. Like, that patina of, like, like the rose-colored glasses of sort of the way this works out. But a movie I think about, and I feel like I've mentioned this before, is in Traffic, Catherine Zeta-Jones. It's a movie, right? She realizes she's like just like living this happy suburban lifestyle in La Jolla, California, and doesn't really realize what her husband's business is. But once she realizes he's in the drug trade, she essentially like takes over. Because she's like, I don't want to lose my lifestyle. And so that's going to mean I'm going to be willing to, like, step into it. But when you watch that movie, it's not heartwarming. It's sort of chilling. Right?
Yeah.
So it's...
And then you think about... did you guys ever watch Weeds?
No.
Ever? So Weeds is Mary Louise Parker. And her husband dies. She's a stay-at-home mom in California. Her husband dies. And she's, like, stuck. She hasn't worked in a decade, 15 years, she doesn't know how to get a job to, like, keep her kids, you know, fed. And so she starts to deal marijuana, which is the first season. And then she gets sort of wrapped up in this kind of drug trade. And she becomes, like, a queenpin.
Yeah.
Like, if that's a word. And there's something really compelling about that whole story, that whole show, because you're like, I've never seen this story told with
a white lady.
A white lady, like, running the show.
Right.
But, I mean, do any of you have recommendation, have a book on your list that's, like, she's the mafioso?
So, the sixth book in Katie Roberts' O'Malley series.
I love that series.
It's so good. It's so great. So, like, the first five are Irish mafia in Boston, and then the last one is Irish mafia princess with Russian mafia head in New York. And the last one, she's like the youngest.
What's the title, Nisha?
Oh, good Lord. I feel like I should have had that ready to go.
Is it The Bastard's Bargain? Is this the one?
It's one of the bargain books, isn't it?
I think so. I think it's The Bastard's Bargain.
This is the one. Its book is fucking amazing. But apparently this was a hero. People were like, there's no way you could redeem him. And I read it in like the first one I read. And I was like, yeah, this guy's fucking great. What's the problem? And they were like, he tortured people. I was like, I don't think I care.
I mean,
talk about making some choices, Katie Robert. Like, in that story, the heroine is basically, like, the hero says, I was promised a bride, and I'm going to take a bride. And the heroine is like, Katie had been building the attraction between the two characters for a couple books, so it's not like the attraction didn't exist between the two. And he gives her an ultimatum saying, like, this is what I'm going to do to your family, or you can marry me. And she's like, well, I guess we'll go with this other option. And she's also, trigger warnings, there's addiction in the book. So,
I laugh only because Eric is always like, that's you two thing. Are going to put a trigger warning on, like, oh, be careful, the horse dies, but not on...
Yeah, it's fine.
Listen, if you hadn't given that trigger warning for that book, I swear to God, I don't know what it would have happened. I would have been texting you at 2 a.m, been very upset. See? Very, very upset. So I appreciate that trigger warning, Eric. That was necessary. but there is addiction in the story, so just keeping that in mind. In addition to murder and mayhem.
The mafia.
In addition to organized crime.
It is The Bastard's Bargain, by the way, guys.
And in that story, she becomes this powerful force that ends up saving him. And I absolutely love it. Like, you can see the character growing into that mold. I think that there are a couple more that I want to say... that, like, have heroines that are in this leadership role in that series. Like, the first book, The Marriage Contract, she is the oldest daughter of the Irish mafia family.
The competitors, or, like, the... enemies, right? Or no, she's the daughter.
She's the first book in that 6-book trilogy by Katie Robert, is about the oldest daughter of the Irish mafia family.
That's The Marriage Contract.
That's The Marriage Contract. And she also has a significant amount of power. And her father is basically like, you have to lead the family and do what's right. And we're going to join these families.
Yeah. It's like a marriage of convenience story.
Yeah. And it's wonderful, the way that the hero and the heroine first meet in an alley. It's just great. So that would probably be another one. I think those are the ones that really attract me the most, the ones where the heroine has really, like, embraced the mafia lifestyle and is like, I'm here for, I'm not exactly excited about the moral implications of, you know, the work that I'm doing, but... if I have to protect my family, if I have to protect the ones that I love, I will do what I have to do.
So for you, it's like tied up in not only power, but also duty or loyalty.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I think coming from a very large Indian family where it's like, you know, I know that there are some people who have kind of approached family as like, you don't have to stay with the ones that... you know, you're born with, especially if they're problematic and they hurt you. And, you know, like, you should, like, do what's best for your safety. But, you know, coming from the South Asian family, we've always overlooked smaller flaws that are just irritating. And it's like, you have to accept that because they're family, right? Like, that is...
smaller flaws, you have to... like being a mobster.
And so to me, in my Nisha brain, for some reason, that's okay. It's
I like it.
Oh, mobster is considered a smaller flaw, according to my mother, and I'm okay with
this. Fair.
So, I mean, but there is also this other piece, right? Which is, so that's like the one way where, like, the hair, and I'm, again, unsurprised, like, Nisha writes these badass, like, heroines who run their own businesses. And
of course that would appeal to you,
like,
right?
You know. Yeah, mm-hmm. kick ass, take names, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's the other side, the flip side, and like this is appealing too in a lot of ways. For all the ways, there's something very, I don't know where I'm going. No, I know where I'm going, but I'm all
you'll get there.
Place. So there's this really appealing kind of almost like old fashioned, like historical feel to some of these books, in that in several of them. The ones that I sort of immediately could name off the top of my head, the hero is basically like, I can't love you because you will be harmed by your relationship.
Yes.
Oh, God, yes.
Like,
so good.
If I love you, I am putting you in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about, like, C.D. Reese has her Corruption series, which begins with Spin, which is short for the hero's name, Spinelli. And he's like the head of, like a family in Los Angeles, like quotation mark family in Los Angeles. And the heroine is like a person who he just like cannot, like she is too good for him. She's like up on a pedestal. He can't touch her. He'll hurt her if he lets himself get too close. Like if he lets her get too close, he's going to be harmed too. Like he can't leave space in his brain for her. And I love that.
Same.
Like I love that in a hero at any time in any book where it's like, and I mean that's like a classic romantic suspense trope too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is if I spend any time with you, you're going to be a distraction and get us both killed. Which I love.
Like, put it on a plate and serve it for dinner. I will eat all of that up. I mean, I think everything about a hero who believes he is not worthy enough is like just so great when it comes to, I feel like everyone on Twitter after this episode is going to be like, Nisha, we didn't know you as well as we thought we did, and we don't know if this is okay.
Well, I do think there are some tropes where you like reveal that you love them and you feel like you're really showing something, right?
Mm.
I think for Sarah, like your example, I definitely think like Cressley's books fit in that bucket.
The Master, for sure.
Which is my favorite Cressley book.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I think the other two are just so instantly like, oh my God, I have to have her.
Yeah, which is also great. Well, I think that's it too. Like the rules of society don't seem to apply the same way. And so then...
That's what it is. It feels so, and it's everything that Nisha was just saying. Like the rules are so intense and so different than anything, like anything in the rest of the world in 2020. But like it feels like in these small bubbles of power and privilege and like the family's rules are paramount.
Okay. So I have a third thing that I think is really appealing about these books. And for these, I'm going to use probably my, outside of The Master, and like occasionally, like I'll dip into one of these. Like I read The Bastard's Bargain, but not like the rest of them. A series I do really like by Roxy Rivera called Her Russian Protector. Is about the Russian mafia in Houston. And the one that I really liked the best was called Ivan. And I think the thing that the other thing about these books is you have someone who is outside of the world who only thinks, like, I swear to God, you guys, I really only think it exists in, like, books and movies. And so you have this innocent who for some reason has to enter into the world of the mafia, right? It's either accidental or it's on purpose. And then they discover that, like, actually there's this whole layer of, like, society that exists underneath what they thought. And I think there's something then really interesting to me about putting a character... And I mean, often, again, it's so cishet. Often it's a woman, right, who's like, I'm entering into this world. And in this case, in Ivan, Aaron is our main character. Oh, we should tell Aaron, Clayton and Aaron. It's Aaron. Remember, Aaron was like, there's never an Aaron. I'm about to text her. Her sister is in some sort of trouble. And she has been told if she goes to this, like, MMA or MMA... MMA? Is that what the fighters are? I'm like,
the fighting thing?
Goes to this gym that's owned by Ivan. She could ask for some help.
I love Ivan already.
It's really great, yes. Right?
Oh.
So she could ask Ivan for help finding her sister who's in some sort of trouble. And of course, she's like, you know, she's with a friend who's like, you can't go in there. And, you know, she's like, no, I can. This is the only person in Houston who could possibly help me. But all in every single one of the series, it's often this plot is like, I'm drawn into a world I didn't really think existed. So one woman, it's her neighbor is, you know, like the cleaner or something. And, you know, and in one woman who actually falls in love with like the head guy, Nikolai, I think is that one, is she's just like a waitress in the restaurant he owns. And so I think that there's something really appealing too about people drawn into the world that's, you know, like you enter into the world that you didn't even know existed. And I think that's another thing that's often really appealing about these books.
I think that, like, to kind of piggyback onto that, the also the ability of the heroine to explore an area that is so fearful for us in real life. It's like she's basically pushing boundaries and exploring an area of like a world that causes deep like upset for us in real life and ends up, you know, being able to navigate it successfully and conquer those fears. That's always like the idea of fear has always been something that's really fascinating to me, and how characters basically overcome it in order to achieve a goal that, you know, is wonderful and shiny and never really considered attainable, you know, in our real world.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of Ivan, her friend is, like, trying to talk her out of it. And she says, these are not the kind of men you go to for help. These are the kind of mm-hmm. men you usually need help escaping. So mm-hmm. then, right, what you're really also doing is, I think, really driving into something I think a lot of us are, like, maybe it's just me working through in romance, which is, you know, pure patriarchy, right? Like, these systems are like designed by men and benefit men, and men are part of them and women are not. And so it's often really like super charged, right? So yeah, a woman sort of mm-hmm. being brave enough to like really uncover that world or enter that world and then conquer that world, mm-hmm. even if it's not that she's becomes a part of like the crime family, but to like sort of tame the man in this case, right, who's part of it. That's my id.
I mean, it's pure id for, I mean, like, it really does harken back to those, like, old books, yeah. Right? Because I'm thinking about, like, Lequette's Lies You Tell.
So good. One of my favorite mafia romances of all time, by the way.
It's so, so good. But I think that, so the premise is that these two were, like, in love, and they are separated by circumstance and, like, what is essentially a misunderstanding. But she thinks he's, like, gone evil and wants her dead. And so she's, like, faked, essentially, like, living a new life, like, pretending, like, because she has a child, too, his child. Mm. And she's hiding in plain sight. And he finds her, and it is like a complete 180 in terms of his focus, right? Like, he was the Don, and now, like, literally he is willing to do anything to get this woman and to, like, love her and treat her the way that she deserves. And there's something about that arc, and it's not specific to mafia romances at all, but like about the arc of like, I have a singular focus here, and it is, I mean, like, I have a singular focus here, and now my singular focus is redirected on the heroine, right? Like, it's you above everything else, which is added to, you know, this layer of morality chain, right, comes into play in mafia romances. And I mean, it's also like, it seems LaQuette does it so beautifully, and it's mm-hmm. such, that book is incredible. And then you have kind of on the flip side where like Jessa Kane does it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And like, she's not like her, those books are designed as like pure erotic romance. Like they are a straight shot of erotic pleasure. But I'm thinking about like the Fighter's Prize, whose hero is also Russian, whose hero is also an MMA fighter and who is tied up in this like world of like fixing fights and like running gambling rings and that kind of whole world. And that goes back to what Jen was saying about like suddenly this like kind of person who didn't know very much about this world needs access to this world, right? She's this is a classic old-fashioned trope too. Jessa has done like where the heroine has to sell herself to the fighter. Right. Essentially, she gives herself as a gift to a fighter to somehow like finagle her father's gambling debts. But in that moment, like he too has, I mean, Jessa Kane heroes, forget it. They see the heroine and like one sentence in, they're like, it's you forever.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's you forever.
Well, sure.
which is like, if that's your kink, Jessa Kane has got you covered forever. Yeah.
But I think, you know, it's funny because you mentioned in LaQuette's book, like the baby. I am not a fan of this. I have a hard time with the secret baby because I'm always like,
oh, it's such a good baby.
Well, and here's my thing is,
I love
see, the I'm always
baby.
Like, listen, babies are so.
Nisha's going to come back for secret baby.
Babies are so fucking hard. Why would anyone keep that shit secret, right? But often the times it works for me is when the heroine, you know, was like, I got pregnant with this man I just thought was like normal. And then I thought or realized that he was tied up in crime. And then I had to keep it secret. And an example of that is Bad Neighbor by Molly O'Keefe. And often that is the one time where I can really buy that like there was a real reason why it had to be kept secret, because I was like, well, sure, you were terrified. But, you know, normally it doesn't work for me. I'm like, fuck, you're just a regular person. It's not a secret goddamn baby. You get some child support and get on with your life.
But this is why mafia romances work so well when they're done so well, because fear is a piece of it. Like when I started at the beginning of this episode, I told you the story of like my dad, who was not in the mafia, like working with a bunch of people who were like ancillary to mafia, right? My dad lived with a lot of like work fear that I think came from these people, this world. Sure. And so I think that that kind of like very realistic, there is a very real sense of like an understanding of the fear for the reader of the fear being very real, right? Like, because how often, you know, we talked over text earlier today about Joanna Shoup, right?
Oh, yeah.
And like, and obviously, like, the devil of downtown, please.
Yes.
Right? Please. In a historical, and I wrote, like, the Bare Knuckle Bastards, right? Like, I've written a criminal, like, enterprise, too. But, like, in a historical, it's kind of, like, smoothed over. It's Vaseline the lens. But, like, when you're writing, you know, when LaQuette or Annika or C.D. Reese or, you know, any of the people that you just mentioned write their books, it feels like real, like it's a real fear.
I also think it's because in a modern romance, we know that means guns, right? Whereas I feel like in historical, you can just have like somebody who you think, I don't know, I think the body count can be a lot higher. I think maybe the heroine has to really like resign herself to really knowing what that means, as opposed to like Jack Mulligan just being like a pugilist or whatever and being able to like hit people. So maybe it feels like, though, because you know, I don't know, maybe that's just me, like in the Vaseline of a historical is being like, yeah, you know, like in a knife fight, how many guys could he really kill at once? I don't know.
Yeah,
I think the interesting thing about Joanna's book is it kind of goes back to the reason why Cressley's book is so great, that like the hero ends up like giving up, like, or is like separates himself from the crime. Did I spoil it? I don't want to spoil. I feel like I just spoiled.
We've talked about that book a lot.
It's fine
on this podcast. Okay. If you haven't read it, More fool you.
Yeah, I'm like, you just haven't sorry been about listening that to us.
My bad. My bad. But yeah, I think that, you know, there's that separation and there's so that morality chain that you mentioned, Sarah, is really twisted within the story to the point where like the heroine is a representation of that morality chain.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and then of course, so, you know, we've talked about morality chain. We've talked about like strong heroines. We talked about the heroine who's very much an ingenue when she walks into it. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about sex, which is such a huge piece of so many of these books. Like the slow burn mafia romance is not really
that doesn't really exist. Thing. Maybe that's why I like it so much. I'm all like slow burn, 20% in.
I mean, I do think I want to shout out Kate Claiborne here because we talk about Dark Mafia Prince by Annika Martin a lot on this podcast, and we have never once discussed the fact that like there is a whole video that is taken of a blowjob in that book where like the hero is literally holding a gun to the heroine's head, and it's not, he is not forcing her, it is done very deftly in her point of view, and he's videotaping it to send to her father to like
scare him
for
right
vengeance. You guys, I know Eric is going to divorce me after this one.
No, he's not.
But the reality is that like this one is like Kate was like, I can't believe you didn't tell me that this happened,
and I was like, what are you talking about?
Did not remember that it had happened because it's consent. Like it's the consent is clear.
But I also feel like I and maybe this is just like the promise of the premise, right? Like I know going in that some banana shit is going to happen in these books because it, you know, I feel like there's the subgenres that push against because they're not taking place really in our reality in the same way. The rules get to be different for a lot of interactions.
Well, and it's like this particular subgenre, it allows for all of this. I'm thinking about, I talked earlier this season about Theodora Taylor, who, shout out, Theodora, I didn't know that you went to Smith too, but now, like, we're sisters forever. You get to be on every episode now. But I wanted to talk about her, Luca, which is really interesting because this is a revenge. Have you read this, Nisha?
Luca? Yeah.
Yeah. I've read Luca. And so he's the hero is the son of a mafia don who is kidnapped by a rival don and like tortured in a cage.
Oh,
like
dear.
Really? So, but it's a retelling. It's a retelling, I think. It's and like Theodora, let me know if I'm right. But like I think it's a retelling of the Minotaur myth. Like, because the heroine who is the heroine is assigned to feed him. Like she's assigned to like go down into this like basement and feed him in the cage. And then when he is finally released from the cage, like he just vows to take revenge. And like it's a real like dark, messy book, right? Mm. But like it feels so much like it's a retelling of that story of like the beast in the cage, like being made, like the kind, decent beast being made into like pure vengeance. And then with the only string, like the only piece of his humanity is attached to this woman.
Yeah. Mm.
And so like, I don't know, this is a crazy subgenre. And I mean, I love it. But a lot is going on.
Like, I feel like we're all very apologetic about the subgenre. And whenever I talk about, my love for organized crime romance, I feel very apologetic about it. Because we know that topics come up that are very sensitive. We know that there can sometimes be a mishandling of certain subjects that could create some, you know, concern or problems or trigger readers. And it needs to be handled deftly. But what I find really fascinating is that we are that apologetic when you have like thrillers and action films and movies that are, you know, targeted to different demographics, and no one feels the need to apologize for those movies, like, or no one feels the need to apologize for enjoying that kind of like action or horror or you know, that kind of media content that has just as much problematic stuff in it. Like, you know, people are praised for liking The Godfather. Why can't we enjoy mafia romance?
Yeah. No, you're totally right. You know that. Oh, you're so right.
You're right. You're right. I know you're right.
You know, we're recording in September, and last week or 10 days ago, the Oscars released a diversity, like, rubric, essentially saying, like, in order for a film to be, we'll put links in the show notes, but in order for a film to be nominated for Best Picture, it had to, like, it had to show some measure of diversity because it's 2020. Mm-hmm. And, of course, like, men on the internet got real mad about, like, well, The Godfather wouldn't have been able to win an Academy Award. And, like, one, like, your favorite movie from 1972 would not probably win an Academy Award in 2020 anyway.
Right.
But separate from that, like, sorry, gentlemen. But also separate from that, it feels like just what you were saying, like, The Godfather is a gift to us. The Sopranos were a gift to us. But, like, mafia romances, somehow we have to, you're right,
Nisha. Right, where mafia romances where,
about that,
where, like, women or heroines are given the opportunity to have agency and to drive a story and to conquer fear and to, you know, have an ability to appear on a page in a way that gives them power. Like, why are we not able to celebrate that? But I feel like this is supposed to be about joy, and I'm about to get on a soapbox, so I'm going to step back.
I was just going to say, Nisha, like, this is the joy episode. If you are getting joy out of these books, you're getting joy out of them. Go. Be on your soapbox.
And I think that, you know, the authors who really appreciate the types of the interesting facets of mafia romance that we've all talked about, and they really do it with care and consideration when they write their stories, and they take chances in a way that can show the different dimensions of humans who are trying to function in these kinds of structures. I feel like they give us, like, a good story that we should celebrate.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that in the beginning I mentioned, you know, like, you guys outed me for my 50 Shades love, but in actuality, I don't feel like it's something that I need to worry about being outed about, because I'm not going to be ashamed for liking, you know, specific romance books when I have identified the concerns, the issues, and the problems that may appear in the story, and I'm aware of them, and I know that, you know, like, they are things that the author should probably focus on developing in future books, but I can appreciate the parts of the story that I resonated with and connected with, and I shouldn't be shamed for liking something because
I mean, to be honest with you, I really have found myself thinking a lot about how, like, what would be the one interstitial if someone's like, we should do it? I'd be like, hell no. And it would be actually not this one, right? I was like, yes, let's. It would be Cops, right? Mm. And I feel like there's this whole Law and Order, like, story that gets told in America that's about, like, cops as good guys. Mm. A lot of the things that's about, like, Devil of Downtown, I mean, certainly the Her Russian Protector series, is there's a way in which, like, the community that gets taken care of by this group of people is one that has been, like, abandoned by the government.
Well, it's found family.
Yes.
It's found, it's like, it's, the mafia is wrapped up in immigration, just, it's wrapped up in race. Mm-hmm. It's wrapped up in this concept of, like, we are not the community that's being protected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the one thing that I wanted to talk about, and I'm not sure, like, how to get there, so I'm just going to, like, I don't know, next chapter, like, is Russian mobsters. I feel like the Italians and the Irish really, like, own.
Right, like, film and TV, yeah.
But, like, in romance, there are a lot of them are Russian.
Huh.
And I wonder why that is.
I think the interesting thing about Russian mobsters is, like, it's like the gentrification of toxic masculinity.
Say more.
Well, like vampires, right?
Like vampires. Like, it is, you are able to have toxic masculinity appear on the page in a way that is easily digestible because of, like, you're assigning it to, like, a Russian identity, and that Russian identity kind of appears through stereotypes that have come out of, you know, Russian leadership and, like, you know, Russian media and things like that. So I think it's rooted in stereotype. I think it's rooted in the gentrification of the toxic masculinity.
Is it rooted in that, like, Eastern Promises movie with Viggo Mortensen? I mean, I do wonder.
We said it then. We'll say it again. Viggo Mortensen can get it.
Part two. I mean, right? Or I do wonder sometimes. Like, I wonder. I mean, I don't know. Like, sometimes I do think, like, right? Like, I never watched, like, the Motorcycle Club Romance. At some point, I was like, I don't understand where this is coming from. And someone was like, Sons of Anarchy. And I was like, what is that? And then I...
No, but Sons of Anarchy came after Motorcycles.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't... Yeah, it's, like, really interesting.
I mean, Kristen Ashley has been writing longer than Sons of Anarchy has been on.
Yeah, but I'm talking about, like... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I guess the timeline of, like, how things bubble up to the surface... in pop culture is one that,
yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess we need a PhD and not just like us.
Maybe it goes back to the saint, that Russian.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like if you grew up during the Cold War, the Russians were so. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of it too, right? Like, it's fear. Like, I really think, you know, fear and sex are weirdly connected, like, psychologically.
Yeah.
This is where we need Adriana. But
I was about to say, where is Adriana?
I know, we need Adriana on here. But, like, it feels like fear is the, I feel like there is this very real sense of us being drawn, or readers being drawn to the things that we are told we should be afraid of.
Yeah.
And, like, Russian.
Every James Bond villain for 25 years was a hot Russian guy.
We grew up, all of us grew up with this, like, big bad of, you know, what would happen if Russia came.
You guys, I still kind of am like, I'm like, shit, we lost the Cold War and everything else. I didn't expect it to turn out this way.
Romance lied to me.
James Bond lied to me.
Where are my Krusty Kohl Russian, like, heroes saving the day?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, in that sense, I feel like...
And even Christine Feehan, she had, like, 12 books about Russian, like, organized crime members. You know, she had, like, a whole series and then, like, additional books at the end of another one.
But we talked about this when we talked about the Kressley Mafia books. We talked about the fact that they felt like she had just taken the Roth brothers, the vampires, and lifted them up and set them down in modern day and, like, made them people. Yeah. And I think that there is that piece too, this kind of
supercharged, right?
I mean, I think Misha really hit it on the head. I think you're right that it is about gentrification and masculinity.
Mm-hmm. Always.
100%.
What other favorites do you have, Nisha? Did you list them all?
I think we talked about the ones that I wanted to hit. Laquette, definitely. Joanna Shoup, Katie Robert.
What's the sexiest one you've ever read? Do you have one?
I 100% number two, Kressley Cole's trilogy.
Yeah, the Master? Like,
oh, yeah. 100. Like, the Master is so sexy. How can you, like, how can you compete against that?
I get to tag Chastity Belts again.
Girl. Yeah.
You're welcome. You're welcome, people who find us by searching Chastity Belts.
I mean, there's also a book in the Christine Feehan Drake Sisters series that is incredibly sexy.
Panther book?
That is not the Panther book. They're witches.
Christine Feehan is one of my, like, she's a shadowed spot for me.
Enter at your own risk is my disclaimer. Enter Christine Feehan at your own risk. But in, I think it's number five of that series. I, like, want to look on my phone, but hold on.
I mean, Judgment Road, which is, like, kind of adjacent to that series, is by far the most fucked up book I've ever read, and
that's a great title.
Yes, of course it is.
Mm-hmm. Judgment Road.
Yeah, they're all, like, Vendetta Road and Vengeance Road, but Judgment Road is by far
I want to live on Vengeance Road.
Oh, it's called
I'd Like to Buy a Home on Vengeance Road.
Could you imagine that subdivision, though? Like, every house would have, like, a real spiky fucking fence. You're gonna die on that thing. I live at the corner of Vengeance Road and Fuck You Boulevard.
We need a map. Menage County, Kansas.
No. This is like...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
This is not in Menage County. This
No. This is...
Vengeance Road is, like, on the corner of, like, Petty Avenue.
Probably in Rhode Island, let's be honest. Like,
it's Turbulent Sea, Christine Fahan, number 6 in the Drake Sisters series, Turbulent Sea. And the main character is a singer who can seduce people to do what she wants with her voice.
Like a siren.
She's a siren.
Like a siren. And the hero is a self-assigned bodyguard.
Self-assigned. Wait, can he be seduced by her voice as well?
He cannot, because he's also a witch.
Oh.
And he is the 7th son of a 7th son.
Oh, lucky.
And it is so delicious, because there was so much buildup throughout the few books in the series prior to that story, because they're like, he, like, they have like this mating mark that they get if you found your mate. You can't see it. The only time you see it is the first time you get it. And then after that, but you feel it. So, like, you feel the person if you, like, touch it. So, like, she does this scene where she, like, licks her hand and he, like, loses his mind.
I'm going to get this book. I'm getting it. Do I have to read the other books in the series first?
There's some things that are connected, because there is this overall arching story of, like, what he's trying to do to break down this crime syndicate, but, and how, like, she and her sisters are targeted, you know, from different people who are trying to basically harness their power or uncover their power. Mm-hmm. And, but I don't think you need to read the other books in the series to kind of... to understand,
yeah,
you know,
and these it's to understand what happens when she licks the mark, which is really all I'm really interested good. In right
it's
now.
It's really, really good.
It's joy month,
joy and licking.
Yes,
I don't understand. I'm a weirdo,
we all are,
but Nisha told me I shouldn't feel bad about it, so I'm not.
No, you should not.
Your joy is just loving what you love and being okay with it,
absolutely.
I feel like we have really, like,
code.
We've done some solid TBR building here.
Always.
You guys are never going to call me back.
We are. You're going to come back and talk about secret babies, and we're just going to make Jen cringe.
I'm just going to be like,
what?
I'll just take screenshots in my face being like, what the fuck?
But, like, truthfully, they're just, these heroes are just, like, they're just larger than life. It
absolutely.
Just goes back to that, like, I want a hero who's, like, huge.
Yeah.
In more ways than one.
Exactly.
Oh, funny.
I remember feeling, so I live in Brooklyn, and you know, there's a very large Slavic community in Brooklyn, like Russians and East Europeans. And I remember the first time I read that series, that mafia series by Cressley, which my friend Louisa Edwards recommended I read, and Sophie Jordan recommended I read, and I put it off and put it off and put it off, and then finally I read it, because I came to mafia romance late, obviously. Now you know why. Mm-hmm. And I remember being at the coffee shop and, like, seeing this, like, clearly, like, Slavic man walk by, and me just being like, oh. I want to go to there. And I was like, no, this is what has Cressley done to me. Mm-hmm. And then that was it. Then I started reading mafia romances. So thanks for nothing.
Well, thanks, Nisha, for being with us. And share with us your favorite. I mean, there's so many. I'll look at the Goodreads list, and often there'll be like 100 or 200 books. Like, the, like, mafia romance books list is like 900 books.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, really
this
long.
Is
a,
definitely
a deep pool.
But I also feel like so many of these writers are, they found their, their sweet spot, and they are just writing mafia romance, which is, you know, great if that's what you're into. They've got you covered.
And I think that that Goodreads list on queer mafia romance was really like my guiding light in trying to figure out like to read more queer romance in this subgenre. So I highly recommend linking that and checking that out. And then and also, you know, make sure you check trigger warnings, because if you've never read a mafia romance before, it's really important to kind of make sure that you protect yourself.
Yeah, these are not like don't go in.
There are no cinnamon rolls.
Don't go in unprepared.
There are no,
no. So maybe go back and listen to the Alpha episode first and then
level up.
Into mafia romance. Right. know what you're dealing with. I think we did a good job though explaining. Like, I don't think anybody's gonna walk away being like, "Oh yeah, this is
why do people listen to this?" Right? Yeah. Why do people read these? I think there's a lot of reason to read these. Yeah.
This person runs a coffee. This person is a baker. Nobody's expecting a baking hero. But maybe you could write that if you're out there and you want to write a, you know.
I know this is like we're at the end of the episode, but I have to share something really interesting with you. So for like consulting work, I've been reading like a lot of policy law stuff, and I came across something interesting where organized crime families are leaving like gun trafficking and drug trafficking and going into like online advertising, because it's really interesting, because 20% of online advertising is like the revenue is created through fraud. And basically what happens is, like, say you have like a family member who opens up an email that has like a link, you know, like a bad link, they'll click the link and someone will like basically be able to see everything that they do in their computer. And, you know, what advertisers will do, or what like fraud organized crime families will do, is they will basically like sell ads, like ad hits to companies, and basically say, "Company X, we promise you 100 million hits in 6 months, and that company will pay the crime family a certain amount of money." And that crime family will then basically go to these computers that they've infiltrated, and they will do what's called like headless browsing or something, where they go and they click on the person's website, or they'll click on like the different, you know, products that they have to show that they've generated hits, but it's all fake. So organized crime families are now going into advertising.
Checks out.
And so maybe you can get a computer.
It's the end of an era.
It's like, I'm waiting for someone to write me like an organized crime family that is just a bunch hackers. Of like software engineers, like hackers,
but,
and software engineers.
You know what's interesting is that makes perfect sense, because like younger people in these families, like they don't want to.
Right.
They don't want to go into like guns and drugs. Like they want to go. These families have a lot of money now. They're like working toward being acceptable in society. Mm-hmm. And so these kids are going to college, and they don't. So it makes sense that they would come home and be like, "Hey, we can actually streamline this
crime. Let's make some money this different way.
Make it safer. No, everybody can just be, they can have a 401k. And
just as long as we're all clear that nobody is kidnapping small white children out of the Midwest. That's all I have to say about that.
What?
That QAnon bullshit.
Where did that come
all
from?
That QAnon bullshit. All these people who like really think that like there's, I like cannot even.
No, that's
stop reading all that crazy news on Facebook, everybody. Like, focus. Focus.
Oh my gosh. I may have gotten the advertising like description or explanation a little skewed, that's but funny. Like that's the general story.
That's amazing.
I mean, it just sounds like classic money laundering, right? Too.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Which is, I remember when I was growing up, there was this, so in Providence, on there's a neighborhood called Federal Hill, and it was where, like, all the mafia, like, that's where, like, the mafia existed in Providence. This is where, that was their, like, main location. And there was a video game store, like a, so it was like an arcade repair store. Like, you could bring your arcade version of, like, Ms. Pac-Man to this store.
Oh, wow.
And they would like repair it for you, ostensibly. Like, that was what it said on the sign. And they had, like, pinball machines and stuff inside this store. And I would walk past it, like, every Saturday morning with my dad, because we would go to this one bakery to, like, buy the, like, Italian, the only Italian bread in the state of Rhode Island my father would eat. And so we would pass this place, and they always had, like, pinball machines all inside this, like, closed-up building. And I loved pinball, and all I wanted was a pinball machine, like, in my house. And I would say every time we went by, like, I really want a pinball machine. Like, do you think we could get a pinball machine for, like, Christmas or my birthday or whatever? And finally, when I was, like, 12 or 13, my dad was like, Sarah, the store is never open. And I was like, why? And he was like, he explained to me that this was like a complete front. This was like a known front for like one of the biggest crime families in Rhode Island. So
yeah. I even have a good time looking this shit up for show notes, everybody. I just want you to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Nisha, come back and talk about secret babies with us.
I will, 100%. And what's, Shakespeare. That's the other one. And let's talk about Shakespeare.
Come back and talk about Shakespeare.
Let's do it.
Because tell everybody, so you have The Takeover Effect and The Legal Affair, which are both out. What is next?
So the third book in the Sing Family Trilogy, which is coming out next year, along with my next YA novel, which is called Ratha and Jay's Recipe for Romance, which is about a classically trained dancer who has to partner with a Bollywood dancer in order to win a competition so she can basically win her freedom for the future that she's always wanted. And my very first adult rom-com is coming out in July. Or no, September of next year. And right now, it is untitled, but it is a homage to Taming of the Shrew.
Nice.
Which I'm very excited
about.
Love
Taming of the Shrew. Who doesn't? Here. Well, that's all great. But we're not going to wait a year to have Nisha back. We're going to have Nisha back for Secret Babies and make Jen super uncomfortable. And then you come back and talk about Shakespeare when that comes out. But Nisha, thanks for coming and talking about stuff that gives you joy.
Thank you for having me.
Anything else? Anything else give you joy these days?
I have to admit, you guys have been giving me a lot of joy. Nice. So listening to your voices and your extra episode this past week was also just when it hit my iPhone, I was like, score.
You know what's going to give Nisha joy? So. She's about to log off and go read Ivan. I got you, girl.
I'm excited.
I got you.
I appreciate Ivan. I'm ready for it.
Well, I'm really glad that we are here for you. I'm glad that you're here for us. I'm glad that you were our cruise director for 50 Shades Free.
It was my pleasure.
Truly.
Even though you guys are all haters, all
deeply
you are haters.
Deeply problematic on so many
movie
levels.
Movie number two, it's great. Movie number two is.
I'm co-signing Adriana's strongly worded letter this week.
It is definitely the third movie and the third book.
It's not as good.
Is not as good. There's a lot of issues. You cannot tie trauma to, like, the BDSM, the kick.
No, fundamentally, Anna. Leave that man.
Oh, God.
Leave him.
Leave him.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He needed to be in cold storage. He really did.
But you know what I will confess that I've watched again? I've watched several times.
Flip.
Is that scene?
The flip scene?
Not the flip, but I do appreciate the flip. Like, in pure
death. The flip scene's great.
The scene that I really love the most in all three of them is the scene where he's just been in the helicopter crash, and then he comes into his apartment, and his whole family's there, and then he's like, let me go say hi to my girl. And I'm like, love that.
My favorite is in movie one, where she, like, goes into the elevator and he goes, fuck the contract. I was like, yes!
All right, here's my favorite. So it's so wrong. After she, like, wanders in the rain for 3 hours and she comes back in and he's like, where the fuck have you been? I'm just like, why is that so hot that you are just, like, so...
I don't know.
He's, like, so outraged. She's been missing. She doesn't have her cell phone or her purse. Go out and find her.
I mean, but the problem is he's just on the phone with some idiot. Why isn't he out there getting wet, finding her?
Because.
Yeah, and also, why doesn't he ever work? guys.
Listen, men don't have to work in romance. Only women do. Come on.
I was very strategic in the legal affair.
He holds Enterprises Limited.
definitely very strategic when I wrote like billionaires, because they're always like, I've worked with like these guys before. They're always working. Why is Christian Grey never working? I'm sorry. There's not enough biometrics in his house.
He works out a lot.
He does.
And he works out a lot.
Work.
And yes, working out. There's not enough conference calls.
Wait, I will say this. So I bought it on Amazon streaming, and on Amazon streaming there's like a function, like you, if you accidentally click a thing, which I did, it shows you like pop up trivia the whole time you're watching. So I accidentally clicked it for some length of time, and it told me that Jamie Dornan was supposed to be, that they wanted another montage of like Christian Grey working out in the whatever one he does the like pommel horse trick in.
Yes.
And he was like, and they were like, but we can't figure out how to get it in like naturally. And he was like, well, if you put a pommel horse in the workout room in the morning, I can do this like yoga thing on the pommel horse. And then everyone will know that I'm like exceptionally well.
Sure.
Like I've okay. treated my body like a
sure.
temple.
Okay.
And I was like, makes perfect sense.
Fine.
Like, I would have appreciated like scenes of them going to therapy. Like, that would have been like, oh. Okay, like, even if
that's
you don't
like
show
the
therapy session,
Adriana's writing right now.
That is the fanfic that Adriana's writing. Oh my god. Like, come on, like, take care of yourself, guys.
The
like,
fanfic
you can't
I'm writing
each
right
other
now
for,
is he
like,
is, she left his ass and he is still in cold storage and working on his business and miserable.
Exactly.
And then she will take him back
having
3 years from now.
He's paying a lot of money in child support, and she's living quite happily. Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's what I was hoping for, right? Like, someone to write fan fiction where she intentionally has, like, taken over his company and becomes...
Yes, tell everyone like, your, like, dark theory.
Yeah. So, it's like, perfect. I have this theory, and this is why I think I love the series so much, because I have, like, used...
You've retconned it.
I know. Like, I've taken the story that's actually written by E.L. James and these movies that are written by her husband, and I have in my mind twisted it in such a way that it's like no longer the original anymore. But like, what I would like to see is like in her perspective, how she intentionally went to his office first just to do the interview for her roommate, but when she realizes the potential of like how she can get in, and she overhears a conversation of like two people talking about like his proclivities, and she ends up like deciding to like manipulate her, like the way that she presents herself to him in order to like rope him in and then take over his business.
Like, she was Christian Grey all
along. Takes over the business. She was Christian Grey all along. That's the story that I want.
It's like Fight Club.
Yes. Yes. And like, you see her like actually like putting on that red lipstick. Like, you see like scenes of that, like, and looking at herself in the mirror.
I'm
and like, that's
it.
The mirror scene I want.
Unfortunately.
She like goes and gets a job at the hardware store because she knows
he's coming to buy zip ties.
Yes.
I like it.
Yeah.
Very, very much, Nisha. That is the book I would like to read.
And she's like a psychology minor, right? So she knows.
So obviously, psychology minors know everything.
I'm just taking it all in, everybody.
Don't poke holes in my bubble.
How much would you have at the end been like, this blows my mind, I'm in love with it?
Yeah, it would have been great. Anisha's pretty busy, but I think she could find some time to write that for us. I do.
I don't know if I'm the best person for this, but...
No, that's a great domestic thriller. Isn't that what we would call it, a domestic thriller?
Definitely. Someone call Jane Anne Krantz. She would do it justice.
She really would. Everyone, Nisha, tell everyone where they can find you on the internet.
You can find me at Nisha Writes on Instagram and on Twitter. You can find me on my website at www.nisha-sharma.com. And you can find me on YouTube at Nisha Writes Online.
And Nisha is a very sort of deeply committed planner who is guiding me through planning. And you can watch videos on her YouTube channel of her planning. Everyone.
Thank you.
This is Faded Mates. You can find us at fadedmates.net. You can get merch there. There is clothing. There are pins. There are stickers. There's all sorts of stuff. You can also see all the music that is in all of these episodes on the Spotify playlist that's linked there. Transcripts are there. Thank you to Linda and Gwen who are helping us with transcripts now. Stay tuned next week. More joy. You have 2 weeks until the election. So make sure that you filled out your ballots and that you have a plan to vote. You can volunteer. You can still write postcards. You can still phone bank. You can still text bank. We are here for you. Stay fired up.
Yep.
Vote Biden-Harris. And blue right down the line.
Hi, Faded Mates. My name is Julia. I'm the Bliss Tour on Twitter and Instagram and those things, but I'm taking a break from social media, so I probably won't be there. But I am calling because I wanted to talk to you about The Heiress Effect by Courtney Milan. I read this book in 2014, and I'd probably been reading romance for a while there, but I didn't think of myself as a romance reader, because I didn't read historicals, and I never wanted to read historicals. Like, back in the 70s, my sister read, like, Sweet Savage Love, and when I was in college in the 80s, I had friends who had Harlequins that had the drawn covers. They traded those, and I didn't get it. I was a sci-fi fantasy paranormal reader, even though maybe I didn't realize that some of those paranormals were romances. So I even read 50 Shades of Grey and still didn't consider myself, like, capital R romance reader. And then I don't know how I got it or found it. It was probably a Daily Mail or something like that. And I started reading The Heiress Effect, and I was like, what is going on? And then I just took a deep dive into Courtney Milan. Her characters are so layered and complicated, and I called to say, hey, I'm explaining what this meant to me. It was just like a feeling. It didn't feel like it was just so detached. They seemed like real people, even though they lived 100 years ago or whatever. So that's what started it. Courtney Milan's Heiress Effect. Deep dive into her books. And then I started on Sherry Thomas, took a deep dive into that. And Luckiest Lady in London has probably the second best prologue of any romance. And then I dived into Elizabeth Hoyt's Maiden Lane. And yeah, I am a capital R romance reader. That's total Freudian slip. I'm a capital R romance reader. And yeah, I love historicals now. Who would have thunk it? All right. Thanks. Take care.